Hello and welcome to the Undercut Podcast. I'm your host this evening, Jesse Billington, and we're back to review the 17th round of the 2025 Formula One season, the Azerbaijan Grand Prix. I've scrapped the dodgy internet of my co-host Timo and brought in a far more pleasant replacement. Leah Halsey, how are you? And what have you been up to this weekend? Because I reckon it's far more interesting than mine.
Hey Jesse, thanks for having me. Really excited to be here. I've had a really exciting weekend. Technically a holiday, I guess you could say. But I've been out in Assen in the Netherlands for the 9th round of the Bennetts British Superbike Championship. So, yeah, I've been out there watching that, living it up, getting absolutely soaked. But it means that I've also, been a bit hit and miss with the F1. But it sounds like we've had a great race on our hands.
A very interesting weekend, and I think you're now 2 for 2 when it comes to weekends for getting absolutely soaked as well, because I know you were down at Goodwood as well, overseeing some video production there, so we've both had wet weekends on the bounce. But yes, we've had a very interesting Grand Prix, and we've had some interesting news actually break around the Grand Prix weekend, and also including today. So we'll kick off with the lead news story of this weekend, and is that Christian Horner has formally left Red Bull now with a £52 million payoff. He was released from operational duties on the 9th of July, and earlier today he was formally released, Oliver Minslav, thanking Horner for his exceptional work. And I don't know about you, if I'd just been given a £52 million payoff, I'd probably just retire.
Yeah, I know. That is mammoth. I mean, I guess if you have to remove the art from the artist. Obviously, he's been with Red Bull since, they were pretty much came into Formula One. So, for his duties, I do kind of. I mean, 52 million is like ridiculous amounts, I think, still. But he could just settle down now. Whether or not he will. I can't see him leaving it indefinitely. I do think he'll come back in some capacity, but he could definitely just retire and live in the nice Oxfordshire countryside. But yeah, that's a mammoth amount. But for what he did for Red Bull, I kind of see the payoff.
Yeah, numerous world championships, several drivers' titles as well in that time with the team since it was sort of founded and built from the ground up out of the ashes of Jaguar. It's an impressive sort of career that he's had statistically. When you start sort of looking beyond just the numbers, it becomes a rather more interesting subject, and one that I think motoring journalists might start to write books on in the years to come, because there are interesting elements to how he's run that team. And I think as we get into the team by team analysis, we're starting to see changes in those teams and how they're being run a bit differently now, and potentially the results that are coming forth from that. Meanwhile, obviously, we're racing in Baku this weekend, and it was confirmed that the Azerbaijan track will remain on the calendar until 2030, which, based off the action this weekend and Formula 2, I'd say it's a good pick to stick around with. People are a bit divided, but what's your overall opinion on Baku?
Yeah, Baku, it's always one, I'll be completely honest, that I sort of feel impartial about until it comes around, and then I watch it, and I'm like, ah, this is exactly what's on the calendar. Obviously, it's another street circuit, which divides fans in many ways. But I think it definitely every year proves its case of why it should be on the grid. And especially with what we've had this weekend, I do think, they've done really well to confirm that for the next, kind of 5 years.
Yeah, it throws out an interesting race here or there. And it's everyone goes, oh, yeah, you expect Baku. You sort of expect the absolute chaos of sort of the two Red Bulls colliding or something like that. But every now and then it throws out an interesting race in a technical sense. Think back to Oscar and Charles having a proper ding-dong last year at the front, where you've got this race where it was about tyre preservation and strategy and sort of having an overall very technically appealing Formula One race. So it can be very interesting indeed. And as we saw with qualifying, it can throw up the usual crash-bang wallop excitement as well, where qualifying took 2 hours and involved 6 red flags, I think a record for any qualifying session. Ironic following Stefano Domenicali's suggestion that we should have more sprint races and shorter Grand Prix to appeal to younger audiences. And then we get a qualifying session that's 45 minutes longer than the Italian Grand Prix. Perfection. I love it. I would love to know his thoughts on that as well.
I know, honestly, I love when things like this happen, because I've not met a single, obviously coming from a slightly younger generation now getting into the sport, I've not seen a single person around my age who has the opinion that they want more sprint races. So I love when this happens, and it proves why we need to keep the traditional format. Absolutely massive qualifying session. Obviously, we had 3 red flags in Q1, I think. So, a lot of action going on, a lot of, it threw up the grid in quite a nice way, with obviously Carlos being up there, but Yeah, a great qualifying session this weekend. Really, really enjoyable.
It was one of those qualifying sessions where you sort of, I know coming into the weekend, team and I, when it came to the predictions, he looked at me like I was mad when I said that we were going to have an interrupted qualifying session, which would result in Gabriel Bortoleto being on pole. And theoretically, in practice, I wasn't too far off. We ended up with Carlos Sainz at one point with provisional pole because they went out, they got it done when there was the opportunity, and then there was an interruption. And this is exactly what I'd predicted. Wrong driver, wrong outcome, but the same mechanism. So occasionally I have these good ideas. Otherwise, McLaren came into the weekend needing to outscore Ferrari by 9 points to seal the constructors' title, but the battle rumbles on to Singapore. Ferrari tied on points with the Woking outfit by race's end, and importantly, Mercedes overtakes the Italian team too. Red Bull's double points finish also solidifies their position in fourth. So a very interesting set of outcomes when it comes to the overall battle. We might as well jump into our team-by-team analysis, starting with championship leaders McLaren. Piastri qualified ninth, technically, but would go on to not finish the race. Meanwhile, Lando Norris would qualify seventh and finish seventh. An interesting one. I'll lead with sort of the rough notes. We'll break into the discussion where 34 consecutive race finishes for Oscar Piastri gone. It's McLaren's lowest scoring weekend since Las Vegas 2023, too. Norris only scoring 6 points this weekend really shows how their season-long battle has been. If Norris had finished second and Piastri fourth, this would have been the same points gain, I think is a really impressive way of putting it, which he could have put in all that effort. All Piastri would have had to have done was finish fourth to really negate it. The McLaren didn't look quick this weekend, regardless, though. It wasn't a comfortable car across the entire weekend. I think this was compounding a few issues. Singapore is also going to be very similar as a circuit. It's not quite so dependent on top speed, but again, you've got a lot of these slow, very sharp radius corners where the McLaren just isn't comfortable. The front end placement is key, and it's something McLaren have been fighting to get on top of across the season. And I think that the lower top speeds might just about mask a few of the issues, but they're going to be hoping we get to COTA sooner rather than later. COTA and Brazil, I think we're going to see McLaren back on form. But before then, we've still got two very tight, very angular circuits of Singapore and Mexico. Bear in mind the amount of 90 degrees it's got out in its back section as well. So, and again, Las Vegas possibly not going to be a McLaren favourite again, where they're struggling for that top speed. While Piastri did bin it twice, Norris's weekend wasn't perfect either. Messi failed to find the rhythm. I think both drivers have come away from this weekend with a lot to learn.
Yeah, not been the dream weekend for McLaren, really. I think if you told me coming into this race, obviously just based on how, I don't want to use the word dominant because I don't necessarily think it's been all plain sailing for the team, but with the form they've been on this season, I think if you had told me this would have been the outcome on Friday morning before any practice session, I probably would have laughed and said, well, this is, it's going to be an easy one too. Especially even after practice, they were still up there. Obviously not like in any easy way, but they were still running really well. So if you told me even after practice three that they would have those results, I probably wouldn't have believed you. Yeah, a really tough race obviously for Oscar with the issues he had early on. Obviously his qualifying and binning it in qualifying didn't help either, but having that jump start and the anti-stall and then having to claw back and doing well to claw back in the way he did and then still binning it. Not the form we've really seen Oscar have this season. He's been pretty faultless, I'd say, on the whole. And then Lando, yeah, he must be extremely frustrated. After as much as they are teammates, it's still a championship battle, and I think it was a great opportunity for him to claw back that, well, before the weekend, the 31-point deficit he had. Obviously, just a missed opportunity there, and with the slow stop from the team, just didn't help him either. But yeah, I mean, Singapore, I'm just going ahead to Singapore because it's one of my favorite tracks on the entire calendar. He was like he had a statement race there last year, after the slight battle he had with Max for a potential championship. So I'm hoping he can replicate that and the team can and come back in that way. But yeah, it might be a long wait for the team until we get to COTA to re-see them on top form again, perhaps with less of a struggle against other competitors. I do think hopefully one of the Ferraris can maybe come back in that battle. But yeah, not an easy weekend for the Woking guys. Big debrief, I assume, after that race, especially with that pit stop, because I think that's the second race in a row that Lando's not had the best of stops. But yeah, difficult weekend for them, and I do slightly sympathize with them, but you know, it happens to even the best of the teams, so it was bound to happen eventually, and it's just a shame that it happened this
It's
weekend.
the pressure of a long championship as well. Bear in mind, I said at the start, we're into the 17th round. Previously, that would have been the final round of many championships up until fairly recently. We're seeing the sort of year get longer and longer and more demanding with more and more flyaway races. The pressure isn't just on the drivers to perform every weekend. And again, this is a team sport at the end of the day. This is why we do the team by team analysis. This is why the constructors is the big title that everyone really competes for. There's more to it than just the two guys in the car. And I think that when you get these moments where it is down to pit stops, where it is down to strategy and the calls from the pit wall, you're reminded that this is ultimately a team sport and there are more players to it than the two guys with the helmets on. So it's, yeah, this is an interesting weekend on a team's basis as much as it is one for the driver's basis as well. So moving forwards, curious to see what McLaren does, but I suspect there would have been a lot of coffee-free Monday morning meetings held today. So, yeah, interesting atmosphere around Woking. Meanwhile, now in second place in the constructor standings, Mercedes. Russell qualified fifth, while Antonelli somehow qualified ahead of him. Had a good weekend in Antonelli, going on to finish where he started in fourth. But Russell would do as George Russell often does, which is absolutely nothing and then appear on the podium. So finishing second place, it is a good weekend for Mercedes, really. Antonelli back on the pace, the form that we really anticipated seeing from him at the start of the year, and Russell operating as consistently as always, especially when you consider the fact that he's been hugely under the weather with what sounds sort of like congestion, a proper sort of head cold going on as well. There were moments where he came on the radio in practice and qualifying where it just sounded like a different man entirely. I was like, that's not George Russell. You've just got a body double in the car for the day because that's not him. But yeah, Antonelli getting there as well. Or given that this was a challenging circuit where the limits bite and bite hard, and we've seen him be bitten at easier circuits, this was really impressive to show. There's possibly been this sort of rebuilding of his form. I think Mercedes has been very constructive with him in the 2 week gap since Monza, especially where they've taken him back to basics. They've sort of put him through the simulator a bit and just built him back up with a good bit of confidence. And again, this is something we often use as a contrasting point to Red Bull when they've had the juniors in their sort of top car and given them nothing. So this is sort of again Mercedes doing what you want them to do with a rookie, and it's good. I think the car was also a lot more stable, and as a platform, it was one that both drivers are able to exploit to their max. And a good weekend for them, and it shows why they've overtaken Ferrari in their constructors too.
I was going to say it shows that Mercedes can Mercedes in the way that we know they can. I love what they're doing with Antonelli. I'll be completely honest, I was extremely skeptical about Antonelli getting that call up so soon after his F2 season. I know he was extremely successful before F2, then he came into F2. That's the first time I saw him was last year. Obviously in that Primacy, and I thought, oh, okay, like he's great, but I don't see what other people are seeing. Obviously hadn't followed him, and then he came into this season, and then I'm starting to get it now, and I love the way that they're harnessing him and his talents. Obviously, like, ridiculously talented. And I'm obviously biased, but he does like a MotoGP bike too, so what can I say? But yeah, I love what they're doing with him, and it's so nice to see him have a good weekend. I feel like he really needed this under his belt to get that bit of confidence. He also feels a bit more settled in the car, and yeah, it just proves that Mercedes, when they want to, can switch it on. Like you say, George Russell, he just has this tendency to just show up and not necessarily do anything spectacular, but just go back to that basic driving ability he has and then just produce an outcome like P2. I think he's under the radar, like, massively. And especially when his seat is potentially, you know, not perhaps as certain as maybe people want or expect, after how well he's done over the past few years. A result like this is exactly what he needs. And like you say, with him battling that cold as well, obviously it's never nice to see them have to miss their duties. But yeah, I think just snaps to Mercedes this weekend. I think they've been my standout of Baku. If I had to pick a team that really impressed me, it'd be those two. But yeah, nice to see them back on the form that we knew they can be on.
Yeah, the way they've functioned and built up across the weekend was one of those really impressive ones. And yeah, I'll agree with you. Antonelli does look like someone sort of digitally de-aged Rossi somewhere along the line. He looks like sort of you've hybridized basically most of the past sort of decade of MotoGP riders into one small Italian as well. There's a lot of the current grid on MotoGP. You go, I think you've got a mystery child out there that's in Formula One, because the lookalikeness is too similar. But anyway, Mercedes out the way. We'll move on to some other Italians and Ferrari. Hamilton qualified 12th after a messy qualifying outing and would go on to rectify that, finishing 8th, while Leclerc would crash out in qualifying, different location to where we've famously seen him crash out before. So would qualify 10th and would finish 9th. And this was a bit of a flat weekend for Ferrari. I think that there's possibly something up with their power units again, because we saw them have phenomenal pace at Monza. And again, we go back to a circuit where we've got a low drag setup where you'd anticipate them really having the top end speed through the speed traps. And it just wasn't there for them this weekend. In Monza, we were seeing pretty much the two Ferraris followed by either a Sauber or the Haases through in the top five across the speed traps. Ferrari, to my mind, just didn't have that outright straight line performance. And I think it forced them to battle a little bit differently, potentially where Baku was a bumpier street circuit with a little bit of undulation. They have to dial that in when it comes to their ride height issues. The fact that the car's sort of pushrod setup just doesn't allow for the right ride height and the plank wear. So I think they potentially had to dial that out a bit. And that's where we saw a few of these issues creeping in. Neither driver was able to chase down Norris when they swapped. Dirty air, the rough setup not helping. And I doubt that surface in Singapore will help much either. The undulating Kota probably won't be a fan either. So it could be a long wait to Mexico before we see Ferrari properly towards the top end. I won't get close to the botched reversal of team orders, because obviously they did swap Hamilton and Leclerc to see if Hamilton would have a better chance of chasing down Norris. And he did lift coming up to the line, but they just timed it wrong. And unfortunately, Leclerc wasn't close enough. Plus, he was being chased down by Hadjar at that point in time. It was a very risky call from Ferrari to try and swap them back at that moment in time. So, possibly best that it didn't go that way. Otherwise, we would have seen possibly Hamilton collecting just 1 point for his efforts, Leclerc jumping up one, and Hadjar jumping up one as well. So maybe they didn't botch it. Maybe they ended up with the safest outcome.
Yeah, it just seems to be a trend for Ferrari at the moment that they're having these really subpar weekends. There's not much more to say really, apart from just really disappointed. They just didn't really show any signs of promise really. Obviously, not great with Leclerc, Hamilton, sorry, having another Q2 exit, and then Leclerc also crashing in Q3, and then just not being able to. Especially with the team orders and everything, not been able to make that impression on Norris. Like, especially when McLaren had such a, I want to say, underperforming car. Like, it didn't make an impression on anyone. So having that opportunity and still not being able to capitalize on it, it just seems to be the story of Ferrari's season at the moment. I know we're going to talk about Williams later, but one of my favorite stats of this weekend is that if you exclude Hamilton's sprint win, because I don't class that as a proper Grand Prix, is that Sainz has got a podium at Williams before Hamilton has at Ferrari, and that blows my mind. I don't know how smug Carlos will be feeling about that, but yeah, just horrific pretty much for Ferrari. And like you said, that they got disqualified, was it last year or the year before, I can't remember, at COTA for the tire, for the plank wear.
Year
I know.
before, because it
Thank
promoted Logan Sargeant up to P10, and he got points at his home race, but wasn't actually at home to collect them, was the irony of it. I think it was
Okay.
23, because it was when they still had Logan at Williams. I remember that being like the whole sort of farce of it, because the news arrived, I think, possibly as late as Brazil that week season as well. They're like, oh, by the way, we're disqualifying Ferrari. And everyone goes, what? Well, they disqualified one Ferrari.
Leclerc, yeah.
Whereas
And Hamilton got disqualified as well, I
Hamilton
think.
got disqualified, he was running still Mercedes, and the net result was it was enough to move Logan Sargeant into the points to score the 1 point of his career, but it was given to him like 2 weeks later at a different Grand Prix anyway. They're like, congratulations, you sort of got a point at your home race. Well done, son.
I know, bless him.
He's now over in IMSA doing sports car racing. I think he's in the LMP3s there, so he's having fun. He's doing something these days, back behind the wheel. But yeah, the Ferrari one is very interesting, and the only way to sort of properly gauge how the Ferrari garage felt after seeing their sort of prodigal son of Carlos Sainz get a podium before Hamilton technically did would be to have snuck into the back of the van that Carlos Sainz and Charles Leclerc rented to get back home after their flight back to Monaco was essentially had to put down early somewhere in the middle of Italy because of storms over Europe. So those two plus two of their mates basically landed in the middle of Italy in the middle of the night, had to rent the only vehicle available, which was a van, and drive it to Monaco, and then send one of the guys to take it back to Italy the next day. So yeah, Joris, I think, got sent back with the van, and the rest of them were back in Monaco by that point. But yeah, there was a great, I think it was an Instagram story from Charles Leclerc documenting the whole ordeal, and Carlos Sainz driving suspiciously fast down the Italian auto routes in a van, as you'd expect. But yeah, I think when you look at the season we've had, you've had Hülkenberg podium, you've had Hadjar podium, you've got Sainz podium at Williams. If you're Ferrari, you've got to be sat there going, oh, this doesn't look good. Even Leclerc's got podiums at this point, but and they keep refusing to listen to Hamilton when it comes to qualifying as well for tire strategy and calls. And this is the important part where you start to get a bit of this interesting negative concept against Red Bull, where Red Bull have started listening to their drivers and they've started to get the performance back. Ferrari refused to listen to Lewis Hamilton and he still hasn't gotten a podium. So when we get to Red Bull, Max Verstappen qualifies on pole, wins. I think essentially he got a grand slam for this because I don't think anyone else led a lap either because he had such an enormous lead when he came into pit that no one got close to overtaking him. So I think this is a back-to-back grand slam for him because I think he had fastest lap too, though I need to check that bit. But Tsunoda qualified sixth, finished sixth, solid weekend for him. But yeah, Verstappen, you can tell he's making the difference, bagging the biggest qualifying margin ever set in Baku, nearly half a second. And his first pole position here, everyone always forgets that he's not run particularly well here before, one win and never a pole position. And yeah, sixth Grand Slam of his career, pole led every lap, fastest lap win. Tsunoda had been struggling all weekend to extract the same performance, but he's beginning to turn it round, climbing now 19th to 17th in the standings. Well, not great. It's a decent result for him off the back of his best Grand Prix performance since Abu Dhabi 2021, where he finished fourth. But everyone forgets that because there was something else happening that weekend. They appear to have changed things though, and but slightly different front wings though across the weekend. So potentially a setup delta contributing a bit to that pace difference. Nonetheless, as a team, they're moving forwards, and I think if the car is getting a bit more practical and drivable, we're going to see Yuki Tsunoda sort of find his feet a bit more and cause headaches for management when it comes to picking driver lineups.
I like the fact that we've seen Yuki have a good weekend because it's been this tale at Red Bull of it being Max and that's it. You know, the number two driver we've seen even some of like really promising drivers go in there and just not be able to deliver, whether that's because, you know, what you want to believe. But yeah, it's really nice to see Yuki up there. Obviously don't know what happened in Abu Dhabi 21. Can't think of anything, you know, don't know why that got overshadowed or anything, but yeah, nice to see them get a good, strong result. It's nice to see them finally maybe listening, I want to say, to the team rather than making it all about Max. Obviously, Max is a result. Great for him. Not much to say apart from that it proves why he's a full-time champion. It's just one of those performances. It's a bit, it's not the same level. I'm not comparing it, but it's just like when we saw him last year in Brazil, and it reminds you exactly why he's as hyped up as he is. Whether you necessarily like him or don't like him, you can't deny how good of a driver he is and his talents in that car. So don't expect anything less of Max, really. It's just that car maybe this year hasn't quite been dialed in the right way as to, you know, necessarily compete with the McLarens. But on a weekend like this, where he could capitalize, he's done it. And it's like, ah, this is exactly why he is where he is and why he's so good at what he does. But yeah, Yuki takes the biscuit for me on that one. Love seeing him up there. So considering he was struggling, for him to still get a P6, I think it's a great result, and hopefully he can carry that momentum forward on to Singapore and beyond.
Yeah, celebrations with the team afterwards, a good haul of points, and I think also great for Max as well, because I know he had his grandma with him this weekend and it was her birthday, so she got to see him win on her birthday, which was very nice indeed. Because they also had, I think it was his mum and his grandma in like the team photograph they do afterwards with like the pit board for like positions, places, points. And then obviously Red Bull do like the big Red Bull spray afterwards, but they sort of pause and let his grandma and his mum like scoot out the way. And then obviously all hell broke loose and you get the iconic shot of Yuki Tsunoda absolutely booking it out of there because he's like a world-class sprinter, because that guy, He's got some nice clothes. He pops off a few fits across a Grand Prix weekend. Does not want them to get trashed with Red Bull. Meanwhile, Max Verstappen, who only knows skinny jeans and a Red Bull top, doesn't really mind. Anyway, Red Bull out the way. We'll get to probably the biggest story across the weekend. Alex Albon qualifying 19th and Sainz qualifying second for Williams. And then we go on to see Alex Albon finishing a very close to the top 13th and Carlos Sainz on the podium in P3. Russ Williams' best starting place since Russell's 2021 Spa and their best finish too, 1,485 days since that. Sainz rockets now from 18th to 12th in the driver's standings. Lance Stroll, the last driver to stand on a proper podium for Williams, 2017 in Baku, funnily enough. And this also makes Sainz the second driver after Alain Prost to score a podium for McLaren, Ferrari, and Williams. Overall, the team's performance sees their lead in fifth expand from 24 points to 29. And it's worth noting that Albon's performance, while he did have that contact with Colapinto, recovered well from it and would have been in with a point or two if it weren't for that 10-second penalty. Very strong result for the outfit. They had the pace early on and they kept it together across the weekend.
Oh, I just love this. I'll be all journalism out the window. Williams are like my local team. They are 15 minutes up the road. I've got a lot of family heritage within the Williams team. So they're a very special place in my heart. And I remember being sat up in the gods across the start of finish straight at Assen. Just ref I couldn't watch qualifying live, obviously. I was out in the Dutch countryside, and just refreshing it and seeing signs P2, and I was like, "What?" I was like, "Are we sure?" I was like, I had to like rub my eyes, had to check it wasn't a meme page because of how many I follow of them. I just love it. Obviously, let me just touch on Albon before I just ramble about signs. Yeah, he did well. That kind of 10-second penalty really does scupper his chances of any kind of points. But going from pretty much last up to where he got to, I think he did very well. And it's nice to see that he can still perform that car. James Vowles, I think he needs to take a bow. As I said, not to be biased, but he's my favourite team principal in the history of team principals. And considering he said at the start of this year that he was pretty much this car was dead in the water and he was putting all his energy into next year's car, they've done, I think they've had a all round a pretty decent season, and this just I just know how much it'll mean for everyone in Grove. It just it's oh I can't, every time I think about it I just can't stop smiling. I think it's absolutely brilliant. Sainz did well. He had so many amazing drivers in better machinery behind him, and he just it's just amazing. And I know I hope he wasn't smug because I don't think it's in Carlos's nature, but it must be great to be able to give that back to a project. Coming from Ferrari to Williams, that's quite a jump, and that's no secret. And there's no disrespect to Williams, but it's just the difference in the way the Constructors' Championship works and where you finish and how much resources you can put into the car. And there's only so much you can do when you've been in the bottom half of the standings for so many years. But him investing in that project, for whatever reason he did it or not, whether it was because it was the best option to him or whether he actually believed in it, I genuinely think he believed in that project. For him to be able to reward them with that, it's just like a little story. I couldn't write it any better if I tried. Maybe a win, but that's a bit optimistic. But yeah, Williams had a great weekend. Well, Sainz did. Albon did all right. But yeah, I can't stop smiling when I think about it. I think it's just the storyline of Baku. And I absolutely love it. And I love that he's the second driver after Prost to get that for the three constructors. Ah, it's just brilliant.
Yeah, the triple across the big three teams is a really impressive and important milestone. And I think what James Vowles has done when it comes to that team and sort of nurturing and sort of fostering this sort of proper family unit nature within the drivers, within the sort of the engineers and everyone that works within the paddock for it is really important, because obviously we saw Alex Albon sort of booking it out of his car to get to the fence line to be there to support his teammate on the podium as well. And you see that and go, yes, that's what this is about. When you sort of look at sort of the fact that a driver sort of looks at both drivers arrived at Williams and both of them went, this is going to be sort of our project team. And you go, Yes, and they've probably gritted in for it, and I think science has been what has been really quite humble about it as well, in the way that he usually is. He's often had a sort of streak of being very critical of himself, certainly with the run of 12 to 14 sort of races where something different has gone wrong for him every single time. And to sort of come out on top of it and sort of finally have that victory is, yeah, he's had a chance to sort of really show his true colors with this, and it's been really nice to see that he's also appreciated the fact that this was a team effort and there were more people that got him to this point than just him driving. As it stands, Williams in fifth makes this their best season since 2017, where they scored 83 points. I think if you take all of their points from 2018 through 2024, add them together, you're still short of the points haul they've got so far this season as well. Where what 2018, 7 points, 1 point, no point, 23 points, 80 points, 28 points, 17, I think just about gets you below 101 that they currently stand on. So as far as milestone seasons go, this is a huge turning point for Williams, and one they can be happy about as they move on to Singapore. The same can really be said for Racing Bulls. Liam Lawson qualified third, and Isaac Hadjar would qualify eighth. Drivers wise, Lawson would finish fifth, and Hadjar would round out the points in P10. But this was the highest qualifying position for a Kiwi driver since Chris Amon at the 1976 Swedish Grand Prix, and a double points finish for the team elevates them over Aston Martin in the battle, while Lawson moves from 15th to 13th in the driver's title. Their setup and pace was good, there's consistency in the performances, and it suggests that while there's been these changes at the top, we've got obviously new principles in, new setups, new strategies, new sort of ways of working through a weekend, haven't been disruptive. If anything, they've sort of tidied up a few rough edges, and it's much the same with the big team. There's a lot of listening happening and a cohesive unit's forming, and we're getting these joint results where the team is just performing consistently and solidly, and you go, ooh, this is making for an interesting midfield battle now.
Yeah, this is exactly, I think, what you get when you stop maybe fiddling around and trying to find the perfect pairings. I think once you set it and stick to it, although we are hearing potential movements that Hadjar might be promoted at some point potentially in the near future. He was very coy in his media interviews on Thursday or Friday. Hadjar was, but this is what you, I think, yeah, both teams are doing really well and just harnessing what they've got, which is absolutely lovely to see. Obviously, I think Lawson had a bad rap potentially after being a bit arrogant's not the right word, but he went into that Red Bull seat at the start of the year very confident, and it's just the nature of the car just punishes you. So it's nice to see him get a bit more consistency in the season. I think a qualifying third would have been a huge boost to him and just shows what a great I've always thought he was quite a good driver, so it's nice to see him perform the way we can, and then obviously to finish in the top five is a great result too. And Hadjar, he's just really impressive this season all round. Obviously he did drop two places compared to where he qualified, but when you consider that's two, you know,
The Ferraris, essentially.
yeah, exactly. If you put them two together, you're like, ah, okay, we can see why that happened. And also just the experience that Leclerc and Hamilton have. He's just been standout this season, obviously. Getting that podium was really special. But yeah, he's just proving why he got that promotion from F2 last year. But yeah, really nice to see Racing Bulls kind of come together as a nice tight-knit unit, obviously, with that shift in team principals and personnel. Is clearly working for, well, the Red Bull family in total with the two teams they have. So yeah, nice to see a bit of consistency there, and obviously it's working nicely in their favour.
Yeah, it's Racing Bulls feel like they've gone back to what they were like when they used to be Toro Rosso, this sort of very not happy-go-lucky, but sort of joyous place where young drivers could properly move through and sort of hone their talents. If you think back to the sort of years of support they gave the likes of Gasly and the half a season of support they gave Albon while he was there was this place where drivers didn't want to leave and could really find their feet and start performing. And I think we're seeing that return, which is nice. Aston Martin, I've completely omitted to write any notes for this. Alonso qualified 19th, Stroll qualified, Alonso qualified 11th, sorry. Stroll qualified 14th. Alonso would finish outside the points in 15th, and Stroll would drop down as well to 17th. And this is just another weekend of pain for Aston Martin. Nothing went particularly right, nothing went particularly wrong. So it's tricky to try and pick apart where they need to improve. And especially when they're finishing behind two drivers that double stopped, Albon and Ocon, especially considering Ocon's incredibly uncooperative strategy of put him onto hards as soon as possible and leave him be. Aston Martin need to find something to do with that car, or potentially they're going to fall into the trap of what Alpine are doing, as we're going to get to in a bit.
Yeah, it makes you wonder. Whereas James was very open in admitting that Williams were putting their engine into next year's car, it makes you wonder if they've maybe not given up, because I'd like to think that no one would necessarily give up in such a, high performing sport. But yeah, just something's not clicking with that team, whether it's, I don't think it's, well, controversially, it's something, the way that team's set up and the way the cars are running just isn't working for them. So Stroll did have a good run out of Silverstone. I remember he was obviously high up there in the points before Hülkenberg came and ruined the fun getting his first podium. But yeah, just this weekend, I hope it doesn't become a common factor for the team going forward. And I would like to see them get some results, especially Fernando with potential rumbles that this actually might be his last season, or one of the last. Yeah, just something in that team isn't clicking. I don't know what. Obviously, maybe Adrian hasn't had his effect yet, because he's one of the greatest. So maybe he hasn't quite got his hands on that firmly yet. But I hope they can start to pick up soon, because yeah, that's not what you want to see, especially finishing behind two double stoppers. It just doesn't bode well for team morale, and driver, feeling more than anything. So yeah, hopefully they can get to grips with the issue there and turn it around for Singapore.
Yeah, it's a baffling one, really, especially because Adrian will have almost certainly had a look at this year's car. I know he was brought in to start focusing on the 2026 car, but with performance as bad as it was, you're going to have brought him in. And also the fact that at Aston Martin, you've got so many Red Bull designers and engineers there already. There's going to be a bit of inimitable influence that they can look at and not necessarily say, "Oh, I'm familiar with that style of design." That there are going to be bits that Newey will be able to look at and make adjustments to. And I think there was a few of those that came through the mid-season with a few sort of circuit-specific upgrades that maybe brought the car back to life. But after that, it's just started to fall away. Potentially, we get back to COTA, Brazil, possibly Qatar, Abu Dhabi. We might see a turnaround in performance when we get back to more conventional circuits, especially the Aston Martin might come back alive, much the same as it was at Silverstone. But until then, it's going to be a long, slow ride for both drivers. Sauber, meanwhile, different side of the argument. Hülkenberg qualified 17th and Bortoleto out-qualified him again, 13th. Hülkenberg would finish 16th and Bortoleto just outside the points in 11th. And for Nico, not really going to be a strong weekend. He was battling lift and coast for most of it because he had debris stuck in one of his brake ducts, just causing temperatures to spike. So his pace wasn't particularly representative. But Gabby was closer to the main field. But again, this is where sort of my suspicions about that Ferrari engine rears its head. Outside of the main pairing, Gabby is the highest finishing other Ferrari-powered car on the field. And then it's a you've got Behrmann behind him a little bit, then you've got the Williams of Albon between before you get to Ocon. And I think, yeah, it's the pace just wasn't there in that engine this weekend. But Gabby was giving it his all this weekend. And I think they got their setup right. Or potentially, if their engine is fine, they got their setup completely wrong and were running too high a drag. So it's sort of one of those things that's tricky to try and tell. But driving wise, performance wise on their side, no qualms. I think there's just a few small glitches emerging in the team. Just as we, again, it's an outfit that's never been particularly strong. And as we're running longer and longer into a very intensive season, we're just going to see these issues start to creep in. And again, potentially, much like a few other teams, they probably started putting a bit of effort into 2026 by now. Certainly, looking at how Audi's project for next year is going, I can imagine it's all hands on deck getting the German manufacturer upright and ready before it takes over the team fully.
Yeah, like you say, I don't think we can really comment on the drivers. Obviously, Nico having that debris stuck in his car for pretty much the entire race didn't help him in any bids to maybe try and get into the points. And obviously, Gabby yeah, he's done a good job there. Hopefully that Audi project can give them something better to work with. But yeah, it's definitely a car setup issue, I think, with Baku, like you said about the characteristics of the track. It can be very punishing if you don't get that right, and if this is just a prime example of that. There's nothing we can really say negatively towards Nico and Gabby for how they performed this weekend. I think they did what they could with what they were given. I think Borsato getting into Q2 was pretty good. It could have gone either way, with obviously Hülkenberg getting out in Q1 again. But yeah, I hope they can fix it somewhat for the upcoming rounds. Whether or not they can, and whether or not they have just started putting all their energy into Audi, is a different story. But yeah, very much a team and car issue rather than, it's just a punishment on the drivers really, which obviously isn't fair. But not much we can really say against how the two drivers perform with what they were got given this weekend.
It's a very interesting case, and I sort of wonder if the Grand Prix were another 12 laps longer, how this might have shaken out. Because if you look at the top 10, you've got both Red Bulls, both Mercedes, both Ferraris, both RBs, one McLaren. Arguably, you would have had the second one in there at some point if Piastri hadn't crashed it, and you probably would have had the other Williams in there if you'd given Albon another 12 laps. I reckon he would have been able to make down that pace gap. We're starting to see a sort of field of two very different halves, and I think we're in that certainly the back half of that field when we get to Haas as well. I haven't got in my notes where Ocon disqualified from qualifying even, and Behrmann qualified 15th. Ocon was disqualified due to rear wing deflection. Just one side of it was a few millimeters out of alignment. So fine margins, but again, it proves that they're doing the work and keeping these cars within regulations, getting rid of those flexi wings. Meanwhile, when it comes to finishes, Ocon finished 14th and Behrmann finished 12th. And they need a new strategy for Esteban, because pitting him early and running him on hards, it's achieving nothing for them. In the past four races, that has been his strategy. He's done sort of these super long stints of somewhere in the region of like 50, 40 laps on a set of hard tyres. And when you're running a tyre preservation strategy, he cannot run as a blocker or a clearer for Ollie, which hinders your other driver. And Ollie's pace was strong this weekend. I think he was able to extract the most from that car. Ocon's result, I think, is worth caveating with the fact that he did have that early contact with Hülkenberg. They pitted him under the safety car, got his pit stop done and out of the way when they're not going to lose a lot of time. And it did mean he could catch back up to the field. Essentially, I think he started on the hards. They pitted him to mediums, did one lap on the mediums, went straight back to the hards because they knew they would see him out to the end of the Grand Prix. Yes, that gives you one less thing to focus on across the Grand Prix, but at the same time, is it competitive? You're hugely undercutting everyone, but also get to the end of the Grand Prix and you start to tumble down the order a little bit because your car doesn't have great tyre management. And unfortunately, that's where he ended up.
Yeah, it's pretty much replica of how Sauber did this weekend. The pair did extremely well to claw back in the way they did, especially with Ollie having that little moment in qualifying too, to come back and to be. He's very close to getting 11th as well, so I think that's a big positive he can take. Obviously, that was against the Sauber, but when you compare the two, that's not too bad. And yeah, Ocon's strategy, bless him. I don't know what he must be thinking. I don't know how much input he would have in potentially not maybe not going against it. That's not what I mean, but in helping them decide the strategy. I don't know how much he would fight against that. I'd hope maybe after this weekend he'll be a bit more vocal, should he think it wasn't the right decision. But yeah, just we've seen Haas have some great weekends, and this unfortunately just wasn't one of them. I just said for Sauber, the two drivers did what they could, and obviously with Ocon having that bit of contact too, probably didn't help him in any way. But I think they did what they could. I think it's considering where they started, pretty decent. They weren't too bad with their Ferrari power unit either. They were, decent enough. But I just hope we can see a better performance in the coming races for them. I hold on to hope with all my might that they change something and help, because Esteban's a race winner, but I think people forget that, with him having a difficult season at Alpine and then going into Haas and not having a hard season necessarily, but just with a different car, we forget how good he can be. So yeah, hopefully they put the car into anything that he deserves. And obviously it'd be nice to see Ollie as well, considering he's a rookie, be put in a high performing car. We saw him when he was at Ferrari in Saudi Arabia last year, how good he can be on short notice in a good car. So hopefully they get that sorted for the pair of them, much like Sauber need to too.
I mean, even when he subbed in Baku last year as well, he was on form when it came to driving the Haas too. So we know that Behrmann's got the form and so's Ocon. It's just there's a few bits and pieces that are still missing from Haas. And I think they're still going through this sort of rebuilding as they've got the new principal in. They're still sort of adjusting a few bits and pieces here and there. So long-term plans, we'll see what happens. Speaking of long-term plans, Alpine. Gasly qualified 18th, Colapinto 16th, not bad. But then they would go on to finish 18th and 19th. 18th for Gasly, 19th for Colapinto, both a lap down as well. The only two cars in the field to get lapped. And I think this is just a case of do better. The setups are fine. The car is tangible, but the overall pace is abysmal. There's just no speed to it, and a messy qualifying for both of them. So much wrong to unpick from their weekend. It's tricky to really know where to start without having an entire podcast into itself about the woes of Alpine this season alone. Because I think, was it this year we saw one of their team principals disappear to Dubai with dodgy Russian money? We've obviously got Flav back in control. There's so many things that are going on at that unit that you just don't know where to start or what the problem is.
Yeah, not the season maybe Alpine would have wanted. Obviously, with that mid-season-ish driver change, chucking Doohan out and putting Colapinto in, we saw how good Colapinto can be with the right car underneath him. He drove the absolute tires off that Williams last year. So to see him come in, and obviously Gasly too, a race winner, performing in the way they are. As you say, only cars to be a lap down in the race. It's just, yeah, like you say, it's hard to kind of properly analyze without it being a whole episode in itself. There just needs to be something that team do, because as you say, everything is fine except it's just slow. It's genuinely just a tractor. They are really tapping into their, Enstone roots with the speed that they give the car. There's just so much wrong with it, and it's so hard to just say it's this one thing or it's that one thing or this needs to be better, because it's just a combination of so many things. I think they'll probably struggle to unpick it all before the end of the season. I hope I'm proved wrong, and I hope they can, because I think Colapinto will be extremely good for the future of the sport, and I do hope he goes on to have a very successful long career. But it's just doesn't seem to be that way at Alpine at the moment. So hopefully they can get on top of some of the things and prioritize maybe the right things. Obviously, they've got much better insight than me just watching it from an outsider perspective. But yeah, I really hope they can do something different with that car for the last few rounds and give Gasly and Colapinto the car that they deserve.
We'll see how it pans out, but obviously it doesn't look great considering the recent post on social media on Instagram was with our current package, we know the last few races will be tough. Time to see out 2025 and keep pushing back at base. I think this is the official announcement. They have turned off any development for the was it, AA521 they're on at the moment, and will be looking firmly at whatever they're building for next year because oh boy, this is gonna be a long one. And yeah, I don't think Singapore is going to be any better for them if they're struggling to sort of have a car that, again, if you look at where and why Gasly and Colapinto crashed, it's low speed control around tight 90-degree bends. I can't see Singapore being a lot better. And if they aren't able to get the downforce on the car in Mexico, they're going to struggle there too. They might be all right in COTA and Brazil. They might be able to start sort of be causing a problem for Haas and for Sauber and for Aston Martin. But when it comes to chasing down the likes of Williams and getting into what's a very packed top 10, I don't think we'll see much more than another 2 or 3 points for them across the rest of the season, which is a bit of a bum note, but it moves on to winners and spinners, where we appoint the drivers, teams, outfits, and people that we think have done exceptionally well or exceptionally badly across the weekend. For me, it's a fairly obvious choice for my winner. I think it's Carlos Sainz, and I'm sure you might agree with me on that.
Yeah, I'd love to give a different answer just to add a bit of variety, but I think if I picked any other driver or even a team in general, I would get yelled at online. So yeah, it's got to be Carlos. What a weekend for him, and what an achievement for the Williams outfit. Yeah, great job from him.
Perfect outing and a perfect drive from him. When it comes to spinners, though, for me, it's an obvious one. It's Alpine, just an abysmal lack of pace. And it must be gutting to turn up to a race weekend as an outfit, know you're going to be the slowest one there, and still have to go through the rigmarole of three practice sessions, qualifying in a race, and come away from it knowing you've learned nothing and have no opportunity to do anything about it either.
Yeah, that is the obvious choice. Can I give it to the Haas strategy department? Is that allowed?
I can allow that. Yeah, we often have some rogue choices when it comes to our winners and spinners. So the Haas strategy department is by far quite a conventional choice, if anything, and well deserved for a spinner.
Yeah, absolutely not. Alpine's the obvious choice, so I do agree with you there. They need to sort that car out. But when it comes to things we maybe can alter, yeah, they need to get a handle on that strategy. They need to give Ocon something different, for the love of God, please. But yeah, they're my spinners, the Haas strategy department. Thumbs down from me.
Do a better job. Meanwhile, when it comes to our predictions, no points for anyone this weekend. Timo and I did not predict a damn thing correct. So we'll try and do better going into Singapore in a few weeks' time. Meanwhile, though, in Fantasy Formula One for Baku, we have a new winner, Panciak's Novartis F1 team on 266 points. Second place goes to the SC crew run by Steffi Singh, netting 211. And third place is taken by Yuki, the rookie, run by Marco Reus, with 205 points. The Cat Dads come seventh this week, 193 points ahead of Ellie Mae's podcast team, the Red Bull Rejects. My girlfriend beats me. Her dream pub quiz lineup, forget the words in the right order, on 181 points rounds out the top 10, while I'm in 11th with Jaffa Cake Racing on 172. Timo's highest score was Champagne Macarons in 24th with 131. Catherine's Curse having an unusually bad week, 62nd and a penultimate with 0 points. Overall, the victory holds their lead, 3,152 points to Tiklias in second with 3,128, and Lando on 3,008, rounding out the podium. Georgia overtakes Catherine's Curse for fourth, Big Reach beating out the non-scoring Scottish outfit. Timo's On the Curbs is the highest of the three hosts in ninth. Ellie Mae is dropping to 13th with Can't Grow a Moustache, and My Mixing Pot sits in 18th, not doing very well this season at all. Kiwi Burner still trails the competition with just 116 points overall, just ahead of it on 1,028 points is Ellie Mae's Red Bull Rejects. There we go. Fantasy Formula One out of the way. And of course, it will run again when we get to Singapore. That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Undercut Podcast. We'll be back soon with a preview of all the action from Marina Bay. In the meantime, though, Leah, where can you be found if you've got content and bits and pieces coming out? Where, if people want more content, where should they be looking for you?
Yeah, no, thanks for having me, Jesse. It's been a great to digest the Baku Grand Prix with you. Yeah, I'm all over social media, at Motorsport Leah, all one word, is where you can find me. You know, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook as well, because I'd like to think I'm older than I am. Anywhere there, it's at Motorsport Leah. So yeah, obviously I'm a bit more bikey, but if that's your thing, or if you want to get into bikes, then I'm your go-to. So yeah, would love to have you with me over there.
Lovely stuff. And of course, if you want any more from me, you can find me on social media at Jesse on Cars on I've forgotten what they are now, Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. I should have known that off the top of my head. I say it pretty much twice every week. And of course, you can pick up the latest issue of Classic Car Weekly and listen to the Classic Car Weekly podcast. Got a brilliant lead story in this week's issue about the Silverstone Classic, which is coming back at a new date this season, and the efforts that some of the racing organizations have gone into keeping that racing weekend alive and kicking. Plus, we're looking ahead to MRL at Silverstone and a few other important features and bits on the side. Otherwise, we'll be back with a preview of the Singapore Grand Prix in about a week and a half's time, I think.